Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're cracking open a really special biography. It's Eve Curie's 1937 book, Madame Curie. What makes it special is, well, it's written by her daughter, just a few years after Marie Curie died, so it gives this incredibly intimate human perspective behind the legend.
Absolutely. And you need that human side because Marie Salomea Skłodowska Curie, born 1867, died in 1934. Her name is just, you know, inseparable from scientific revolution. I mean, just think about it. She was the first woman ever to win a Nobel Prize.
Right.
And she's still the only person, man or woman, to win Nobel Prizes in two different scientific fields. Physics in 1903, chemistry in 1911.
It's just staggering when you put it like that. Mm-hmm. So our plan today isn't just to list off awards. We really want to trace that human story, the journey. How does someone starting in poverty in Russian-occupied Poland end up redefining possibilities for women and, well, changing our whole understanding of the physical world?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And to get it, you really have to start right at the beginning. Warsaw, 1867. Poland wasn't even technically on the map as a country then. It was under harsh Russian rule, and anything Polish language, culture, identity was actively suppressed. This wasn't just background noise. It deeply shaped her.
That context of oppression is so important, isn't it? Her father, Władysław Skłodowski, he was a physics teacher.
Yeah.
But because he was a Polish patriot, he faced, you know, serious setbacks under the Russian system. Still, he managed to instill this intense love of learning in his kids. Secret lessons in Polish history, science.
Right. The biography calls their home a temple of learning under siege. Can you picture that? Hiding scientific gear from Russian inspectors, it makes learning itself an act of defiance, doesn't it?
It really does. And that defiant spirit probably helped her cope with some truly devastating early losses.
Mm.
Her older sister Zofia died from typhus when Marie was just 7. And then her mother, Bonisław, died of tuberculosis when Marie was 11. Those back-to-back tragedies seem to have forged this, well, this deep stoicism in her and this fierce drive to make her life count for something.
Absolutely. But that fierce drive immediately ran into a wall. She was brilliant, no question. But in Warsaw, universities were closed to women, and the family had absolutely no money for her to study somewhere else, like Paris.
Which brings us to this really famous part of her story, what her daughter Eve called the Sublime Pact.
Yeah.
It was an agreement with her sister, Bronya, right? Tell us about that.
It was extraordinary. Basically, a 6-year deal. Marie agreed to work as a governess way out in the Polish countryside. Miserable job, really isolating. But she sent almost every ruble she earned to Paris.
To fund Bronya's studies.
Exactly. Bronya was studying medicine. The deal was, once Bronya became a doctor and got established, she'd then pay for Marie's turn to go study at the Sorbonne in Paris.
6 years. That's incredible patience and sacrifice. And those years as a governess must have been an intellectual desert for someone like her.
Oh, completely. Lonely, far from any intellectual stimulation. But she didn't just wait. She devoured books on advanced math and physics by candlelight. She even got involved with this secret underground floating university back in Warsaw whenever she could, just anything to keep learning, to stay ready.
So when she finally gets to Paris in 1891, the struggle changes, but it doesn't stop. She launches into this period of what Eve Curie calls legendary frugality.
Legendary is right. We're talking unheated attic rooms, freezing cold, sometimes living on basically just bread, butter, and tea for days. It sounds like extreme poverty, and it was, but it was also a choice, a kind of stripping away everything non-essential.
Driven by this single-minded devotion to study, as the book says.
Totally. Nothing else mattered but learning.
And academically, it worked. She graduated first in her physics class in 1893.
First.
And then second in mathematics in 1894. Just amazing results.
Yeah.
So after all that, she's proven her brilliance. But where does she go next?
Yeah.
She needs resources, maybe a collaborator. Yeah. For doctoral work, right? Especially as a woman in that era.
And that's when fate, or maybe shared scientific passion, intervenes. She meets Pierre Curie in 1894. He was already a respected physicist. Their connection was, by all accounts, immediate and based on this shared, almost obsessive love for science.
Right. Their courtship letters were apparently full of magnetism and crystallography discussions.
Exactly. Not exactly typical romance. And when they married in 1895, her wedding dress wasn't white. It was a practical dark blue dress she could wear right into the laboratory the next day.
That really says it all about their priorities, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so she needs a doctoral thesis topic. She chooses to investigate these strange uranium rays that Henri Becquerel had recently discovered.
A brilliant choice. And right away, she makes two huge contributions. First, she needs a name for this phenomenon, this energy. She coins the term radioactivity.
Okay, that's a big one.
Huge. And second, she notices something crucial that everyone else seems to be missing about why these rays are happening.
What was the prevailing thought back then, before her insight?
Well, most people thought it was some kind of chemical reaction, maybe like fluorescence, something happening between molecules or atoms. But Marie did incredibly precise measurements. She found the intensity of the radiation depended only on the amount of uranium or thorium present.
Regardless of its physical state or chemical compound.
Exactly. Wet, dry, powdered, in a solution didn't matter. Only the quantity of the element itself mattered.
Okay, so why was that observation such a game changer?
Because it meant the energy couldn't be coming from interactions between atoms. It had to be coming from within the atom itself. She hypothesized that radiation was an intrinsic atomic property.
Ah, so the atom wasn't this solid, indivisible little ball like everyone thought.
Precisely. It meant the atom itself was dynamic, active, capable of releasing energy. This idea, this hypothesis, was revolutionary. It basically undermined the entire foundation of classical physics and, you know, opened the door to the whole atomic age.
Wow. And that discovery, that hypothesis, leads them to the most iconic phase of their work, right? The 4 years in that awful shed.
Oh, the shed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dilapidated, leaky roof, no proper heating or ventilation. It was brutal work. They were processing literal tons of pitch blende ore, this industrial waste product.
Why so much?
Because they suspected there were other, much more radioactive elements hidden in the pitch blende, but in absolutely minuscule quantities. So they had to boil, filter, crystallize, refine. Just back-breaking, painstaking chemical labor for 4 solid years.
And it yields these incredible results in 1898. Two new elements.
Polonium, which Marie deliberately named after her homeland, Poland, and radium, which was astonishingly radioactive.
And that work culminates in the 1903 Nobel Prize in Physics, shared with Pierre and Becquerel. But there was a catch there, wasn't there?
There was. Initially, the Nobel Committee nominated only Pierre and Becquerel. It was Pierre who insisted, absolutely insisted, that Marie's foundational theoretical contribution be recognized and that she be included.
Good for him. A true partnership. But then, just a few years later, tragedy strikes, 1906.
Yeah. Pierre was killed instantly in a horrific street accident, run over by a horse-drawn carriage. Utterly devastating for Marie.
How did she even cope with that?
Her response was just remarkable defiance. The French government offered her a widow's pension, the standard thing. She flatly refused it.
Yeah.
Instead, she demanded and got his professorship at the Sorbonne. She stepped into his role, becoming the first woman professor in the university's entire 650-year history.
Incredible. Turning grief into this powerful continuation of their shared mission.
Exactly. And she pushed forward, cementing her own independent legacy. That led directly to her second Nobel Prize, this one in chemistry in 1911, specifically for isolating pure metallic radium, a huge feat of chemistry.
And her work didn't stop there. During World War I, she applied her knowledge in a very practical way.
Right. She developed mobile X-ray units, field radiography stations, essentially. They became known as petite curies, little curies. She even trained women as operators and went to the front lines herself. They saved countless soldiers' lives by locating bullets and shrapnel.
From pure research to life-saving application, it's an amazing arc. Looking back at this whole journey, what would you say was her core philosophy? What really drove her through all this?
At its heart, I think it was pure scientific rationalism, a deep belief that the universe worked according to laws that could be discovered, tested, measured. If you couldn't measure it, it wasn't quite real to her in a way.
And that rationalism extended her ethics too, right? The famous decision about radium.
Absolutely central. Hmm? She and Pierre discovered how to isolate radium. They could have patented the process, become incredibly wealthy, but they refused. Marie's stance was crystal clear. Radium is not to enrich anyone. It belongs to all people. Knowledge was for humanity, period.
That's such a powerful statement of values and how she handled adversity.
Yeah.
You mentioned stoicism earlier. It feels like more than just enduring hardship.
I'd call it productive stoicism. It wasn't passive acceptance. It was about focusing her energy. She couldn't control the political situation in Poland or the lack of funds or the sexism she faced. But she could control her dedication, her focus, her work ethic. She seemed to believe her response to obstacles was entirely within her power.
That image of her working for years in that freezing, leaky shed when anyone else would have just given up. That's productive stoicism right there. Just keep doing the work.
Exactly. And that strength was definitely tested at key moments, real turning points that shaped her path. The first one actually happened quite early on, after her mother's death in 1878.
Right. You mentioned the loss, but it had a deeper consequence, too.
It did. According to Eve Curie, that period coincided with a complete loss of her Catholic faith. She emerged from that experience as a lifelong agnostic. It seems she replaced traditional religious belief with this almost, well, mystical devotion, as the book puts it, to truth and the scientific method. That became her guiding light.
A fundamental shift in her worldview right at the start. What was the second big turning point?
Undeniably, meeting Pierre Curie in 1894. It was more than just finding love. It was finding her perfect intellectual partner. He provided the collaboration, the equality, and frankly, the legitimacy that was absolutely essential for a woman scientist to thrive, maybe even survive, in that intensely male-dominated world.
He championed her work right from the start. And the third turning point. Mm-hmm. This one sounds more like a trial by fire.
Oh, it was. The Langevin affair in 1911. Just as she was about to receive her second Nobel Prize, a huge scandal erupted in the French press. It involved vicious, often xenophobic, and deeply sexist attacks over her relationship with a fellow physicist, Paul Langevin, who was married but separated.
What was the impact of that? Must have been awful.
Immense pressure. The press was brutal, attacking her as a foreigner, a homewrecker, questioning her morals. Even the Nobel Committee quietly suggested she should perhaps decline the chemistry prize to avoid tarnishing its reputation.
Wow. After all that work, how did she respond?
With dignity and defiance. She refused to be silenced or shamed. She attended the Nobel ceremony. And she made a clear stand, basically saying her scientific work was completely separate from her private life. It was a really important moment, setting a precedent that women should be judged on their achievements, not subjected to moral witch hunts.
That brings up some really relevant lessons for us today, doesn't it? Especially thinking about how we deal with obstacles or public scrutiny in our own lives.
Absolutely. Lesson one is how she dealt with systemic barriers. She faced constant sexism, like being denied membership in the French Academy of Sciences, even after her first Nobel, and xenophobia, too. But her response wasn't really protest in the way we might think of it today.
What was it then?
It was incontrovertible data, superior results. Winning that second Nobel Prize later the same year, the Academy rejected her. That was her answer. Ultimate vindication through sheer excellence.
Let the work speak for itself. And the second lesson has to be about integrity, right?
Definitely. We talked about not patenting radium, that fundamental belief that discovery is for everyone. But think about Pierre, too. He famously refused the French Legion of Honor decoration. He told them he didn't need a decoration, he needed a laboratory. Their focus was always on the substance, the contribution, not the status or the profit.
A powerful reminder in today's world. And what about fame itself? She became one of the most famous women in the world. How did she handle that?
She mostly hated it. The biography makes it clear she found celebrity deeply uncomfortable. She always preferred the lab to the limelight. She only really leveraged her fame when she had to, like, those tours in the U.S. later in life.
Why did she do those?
To raise funds to buy more radium. Radium was incredibly expensive, and she needed it for the Radium Institute she founded in Paris. So fame became a tool, a necessary evil, to support the actual scientific work, never the goal itself.
Which leads us, sadly, to the final tragic irony of her life.
Yeah. Her death in 1934 from aplastic anemia, it was almost certainly caused by her decades of exposure to radiation, handling radioactive materials constantly, often carrying test tubes of radium in her pockets because they glowed beautifully. They just didn't know the dangers back then.
The very thing she discovered and gave to the world ultimately took her life. A devastating price for discovery.
It truly was a stark reminder of the physical toll and the necessary ignorance that accompanies pioneering work.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Eve Curie's portrait of her mother, let's try to boil it down. What are the key takeaways for you, the listener? We always like to end with three clear insights.
Okay, let's try.
First, let's find an emotional insight.
All right.
What's a core human feeling or lesson here?
For me, it's that the story of Marie and Pierre Curie is fundamentally a tragic, beautiful love story set in a lab. And Marie's life after Pierre's death in 1906, taking his place, finishing their work, dedicating her entire remaining life to it. It's this incredibly profound example of how love and terrible grief can be channeled, transformed into a sacred lifelong mission.
That's powerful. Okay, second, an intellectual insight. What's the big idea we should grasp from her scientific work?
It has to be her core realization that radioactivity wasn't chemical. It came from within the atom itself, that single conceptual jump. The idea that the atom wasn't the fundamental indivisible unit, but a dynamic source of immense energy, that's what shattered 19th century physics and truly launched the atomic age and everything that followed.
It changed everything. And finally, a universal insight. What's the practical lesson anyone can take from her life, regardless of their field?
I think it's that perseverance, sheer doggedness, is often indistinguishable from genius. Her life is the ultimate argument against waiting for perfect conditions. The leaky shed, the poverty, the prejudice. She didn't wait. She started the work right there with whatever tools she had. The lesson for all of us is just that. Begin the work. Don't wait. Start now, wherever you are, with whatever you have. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.